Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The Wyoming legislative session has ended, and Governor Gordon has some concerns about bills that may be taking away local control.
I don't like it, that approach, and I really do struggle with it.
We dig deeper to see if a bill just signed by the governor would run afoul with federal law.
And get what they wanted, so they're passing what essentially amounts to an illegal law.
One of the largest coal companies in North America, Westmoreland, has gotten permission to cut health care from hundreds of retirees.
Now my beard turned gray and it was my turn to collect, and they don't want to pay me.
And Wyoming's congressional delegation weighs in on the president's so-called emergency for the wall. Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. A judge is set to confirm that yet another bankrupt coal company can end health benefits for hundreds of retired miners and their families. Westmoreland is one of the largest coal companies in North America. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
2 years ago, Jim Bills retired from the Kimmer Mine.
After spending 7 years in the Air Force, I spent 36 years with Westmoreland Coal. And I just retired 2 years ago.
He worked as a laborer, truck driver, and driller. His son works there now too. Bills recalls watching retirees taken care of year after year. He was excited when his time finally came.
Now my beard turned gray and it was my turn to collect, and they don't want to pay me.
Now he says one medical emergency could wipe away his and his wife's retirement fund.
And that's just unacceptable. It's greed. It's corporate greed is what it is.
Last October, Westmoreland filed for bankruptcy protection for the third time. The company had over $1 billion in debt. It blames a weak coal market for its demise, along with admitting it took on way too many loans trying to expand its operations. Mike Dalpaz with the United Mine Workers of America says this particular mine has been profitable for over a century. He blames Westmoreland's bad management.
It's like a blind man trying to run a coal mine.
A Texas judge granted Westmoreland permission to shed hundreds of millions of dollars in liabilities. Adding to local anger, Dalpaz points out Westmoreland gave its executives huge bonuses last year.
You know, the problem is bankruptcy laws are made for corporations. They're made by rich guys in Congress for rich guys that own corporations.
UCLA law professor and bankruptcy expert Lynn Lepucki says debtors have an advantage over employees because they're able to choose where to file. In Westmoreland's case, Houston, despite being headquartered in Colorado.
The situation you have now is that courts literally compete for the bankruptcy cases. The courts are changing what they're doing, which I have said is corrupting.
Houston is the third most common city for bankruptcy cases. The top two are in Delaware and New York, with nearly 60% of cases taking place there in the U.S.
The way that they attract the cases is by making the kinds of rulings that are attractive to the people who can bring the cases. Management is central to that. So they're the people who tend to be taken care of in bankruptcy cases.
A bill has come up repeatedly in Congress to end forum shopping. A staffer for Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren says the legislator is planning to reintroduce the bill this Congress. Westmoreland's lawyer Michael Slade says it's bankruptcy code that obligated the company to negotiate with the union in good faith. He says it's helped create solutions. It wasn't always like that.
So if this had happened in the late 80s, I think what you would have seen is a prompt rejection of all these obligations with nothing flowing to the retirees and to the employees.
Slade says Westmoreland has been fighting hard for their workers and retirees. It's just an unfortunate climate for coal right now.
This is not the retirees' fault. It is not the employees' fault. It's not the company's fault. It's just the market, which is absolutely terrible.
Slade says it shouldn't be taken for granted that Westmoreland worked hard to maintain workers' pension plans, and debtors are providing a year's worth of health care benefit payments. He says it's in everyone's interest for the company to get solvent.
Liquidation is worse for everyone. They would lose their jobs. The mines would not continue to operate, and that would cause a lot of problems.
The benefits would help transition workers into a long-term congressional health care plan. The American Miners Act of 2019 is yet to be approved, but it's just the latest version of a bill aimed at helping coal workers. The Kimmer Mine will soon be getting a new owner, billionaire executive Tom Clark. Many doubt the mine's future profitability, though, given the power plant next door already has a retirement date. Mike Delpez says the fight for benefits is miles away from being over, with new collective bargaining agreement negotiations underway. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Governor Mark Gordon's appointee for Attorney General is only the second woman to serve in the position. Bridget Hill was sworn in by the state Senate this week, marking an already significant career serving the state of Wyoming. Most recently, she directed the Office of State Land and Investments. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson met up with Hill in her Cheyenne office to discuss her new role as Attorney General.
Coming into this new role, are there issues that feel particularly urgent to you or things that you see as priorities for your tenure as Attorney General?
I don't know if I see something pressing more than anything. Things come up at times in the Attorney General's office and you have to deal with them as they come up. Priorities, I think I would like to focus on making this the best law office in the state. So as you know, we're representing all the agencies of the state. I think we should be the subject matter experts in the law related to those agencies that we represent. Additionally, I know that our natural resources are a priority for the governor. So that would be our water, our wildlife, our lands. Those are a big focus for the governor. So I know that means that as his legal representatives, that will be a big focus for us as well during his time as governor. And then the last one that I would point to is our consumer protection unit. Our consumer protection unit gives us a little better ability to interface with the public more one-to-one than we do in our other roles. And so I'd want to focus on that to be a help to the citizens of the state of Wyoming.
Over the last year, there have been several officer-involved shootings in Wyoming, and that's brought a conversation about use of force to the surface. You know, do you have a sense of what your office's role should be in conversations about things like police use of force?
Well, obviously I'm brand new to the job, and so I haven't had a chance to hear what conversations have already occurred. But I do think our peace officers' standards and training, as well as our law enforcement academy, are out there to be a resource to all our law enforcement officers in the state. And so if we can help people better train and better prepared for those types of situations, it makes all the sense in the world for us to be involved in that.
So another question that I want to ask you about is clergy abuse. And in particular, because the Attorney General in Colorado just announced an independent investigation there, looking at how the Catholic Church historically has handled the issue. And we have an open investigation going on in Wyoming. It's happening right here in Cheyenne. And one of the reasons that the Diocese of Cheyenne pushed the police to reopen this case, which was originally closed in 2002, is the diocese says that that initial investigation was flawed. And so I'm wondering, you know, seeing as Colorado has launched an investigation, seeing that Pennsylvania Attorney General's investigation yielded information about a cover-up. There were like over 300 priests and over 1,000 victims that came out of that state-level investigation of the issue. I'm wondering if that is also something that's on your radar as the Attorney General in Wyoming.
Well, I just generally know of the issue. Again, I'm new enough to the office that I haven't been able to hear fully about what that situation is and where we are. And so at this time, I wouldn't have any further idea or comment.
I guess I'm curious how it ends up on an Attorney General's radar.
Well, I think we've got to talk to or get our arms around what the full issue is and then understand in our process, our legal process, how we get there. There are various statutes that talk about when we undertake an investigation, and obviously we would need to follow those statutes and see. We're aware of topics out there, and when we become aware of topics, understanding whether we want to undertake an investigation or not becomes a matter of understanding what the issue is, if we're the best position to do that sort of investigation, and then whether we can under our authorities. You know, I think we've got great people in the state, great law enforcement people, including our Division of Criminal Investigations, who keep their focus on law enforcement problems that are out there. And so I think just being nationally aware of problems that are out there keeps us informed and in a position to take action when we need to.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you about is, it's my understanding that you're the second woman to hold this role as Attorney General in the state of Wyoming. I'm wondering how you feel about that.
Wow. You know, I am honored, first of all, to be the second woman and following a really great woman Attorney General that was the first woman, Gay Woodhouse, who did a great job. I'm honored by that. At the same time, I guess I thought, growing up in Wyoming, well aware of our history with women's rights and being the first state to recognize women's right to vote, I will say I just assumed it was well known that women could do anything that they wanted and would, if they wanted a job, would be able to get it. And so in a lot of ways, I believed it was always a possibility.
Bridget Hill is Wyoming's new Attorney General. Good luck with your new appointment, and thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it and appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
When we come back, we'll take you to a couple of unusual winter sports events. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. What do you get when you put together a horse, a pair of skis, and two daredevils? An old sport that's being revived across our region. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen explains.
I'm just outside of Saratoga in southeast Wyoming. It's not unusual to see horses out here on the prairie, but the ones I'm looking at, not so usual. They're wearing a saddle, normal, with a rider on it, normal, but attached to the saddle is a long rope, and attached to the rope is someone on a pair of regular downhill skis. The horses are galloping parallel to an obstacle course, with the skiers getting dragged through it. Some don't make it. The ones that do end up at a 5-foot-tall jump and fly through the air, hopefully to a smooth landing. This is skijoring. It got started in Norway in the mid-1800s. It comes from a Norwegian word that means ski driving, and it's based on Native American dog sledding traditions. Today, skijoring races take place in Europe and across the U.S. Saratoga hosts a race every year.
Contestants! Contestants!
It's day two of the weekend tournament, and contestants have gathered at the finish line for a quick meeting this morning. Will Faust has helped organize the event since races started here 3 years ago. He says this year, the course is especially technical.
So there were some really good wipeouts and crashes, and I had one of them, and I'm really hurting.
But that won't keep him from getting back on his skis today.
It's a ton of fun. You get to invite all your friends here. But we'll turn it over to Rick here for a second. Yeah.
All right, guys, let's get another day kicked off. About the same rules as yesterday. Remember, no alcohol until after we're done playing.
Rick Hughes also reminds contestants to stay off the course when it's not their turn and to stay alert of their surroundings, since horses will be warming up before they head down the track. Earlier in the day, I walked the course with one of the volunteers. Joy Severine says the first year, conditions were so warm and dry, they had to bring in their own snow on both days of the tournament.
We had to rebuild the track from scratch Sunday morning. We were all here about 5 o'clock in the morning.
But this year, he says they got lucky since it's been snowy here.
With the really cold snap that was happened last week, the snow actually stayed.
As we walk the track, Severine explains the sport. Each team has two people, one riding a horse and one on a pair of skis. It's a straight shot, but there are obstacles along the way, and several poles along the course with several large rings attached to them.
And then first up, you're going to have to grab a ring.
The skier is supposed to hook one ring from each pole with the arm not being used to hold on to the rope.
And then or go around a gate, so red is right, left is blue.
And like a traditional downhill ski race, you get seconds added to your time if you're on the wrong side of the gate. Same is true if you miss a ring or drop it before the finish line.
Then a big jump that will send you up in the air.
So not your average ski run.
No, not your average ski run, no.
The objective is simple. Get to the end of the track as fast as you can. Competitor Gwen Parker says it's that easy and it's that hard.
And I grew up skiing, but downhill, not dragging behind a horse at 30 miles an hour if I'm lucky, so.
She also grew up riding horses, so Parker does both parts of the sport. When you're on top of the horse, Parker says you want to stay as close to the track as you can and keep your horse going at a consistent speed.
So that, you know, when they're going off a jump, you don't pick up into another gear and just jerk them out of the air with nothing beneath them.
When you're skiing, she says the strategy is pretty much just to hold on tight. It's almost her turn to go.
I get a little nervous, but then as soon as that horse gets going and you're holding onto the rope, you're like, oh, okay, I might be all right. Until they pick up that third gear. And then you're like, well, I changed my mind.
Parker makes it through the track without wiping out or letting go of the rope. It's not a good enough time to win a cash prize, but she's okay with that. That's not what keeps Parker coming back each year.
The fact that you get to hang out with all of these different kinds of people and that it's just like, you feel really good when you make it to the end of the track alive. And with a good time.
This weekend, there were some wipeouts and a few injuries like a broken wrist, but everyone did make it out alive. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
In northeast Wyoming, the depths of February don't have a great track record for tourism. So this year, one town hosted its first ever winter rodeo to help bring some excitement and visitors. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler was there for Sheridan's big day.
An average February weekend in Sheridan is cold, snowy, and pretty empty. That's where Sean Parker, the executive director for Sheridan Travel and Tourism, saw an opportunity.
We identified the slowest, deadest month of the year. It's, of course, February, the worst weekend of the year for the tourism economy. And we said, that's when we're going. That's what we're going to target. So we gave ourselves a challenge right out of the bat, knowing that this is the worst weekend that we have historically.
That's when Parker saw a chance to bring more people to town and capitalize on the season. Sheridan and its businesses rely on tourism to support the local economy.
The bulk of our businesses, of course, during the summer, we see so much traffic, people going to Yellowstone and other national parks. We have a really great winter recreation scene for cross-country skiing and snowmobiling, but it pales in comparison to the size of our overall business in the summer.
Parker had some help thinking of a way to bring some excitement into town.
Last year, we hired a new city engineer named Hans Mercer, and Hans is a huge ski-joring enthusiast.
A year ago, I went to Sundance and competed. Just out of the blue, had never done it, never watched it before.
That's Hans Mercer.
Got hooked up with it, and I did it, and it's a feeling of accomplishment and fun that just doesn't go away.
Parker and Mercer worked together with lots of folks in Sheridan to plan a festival that reflected the town's culture. They came up with the idea for a winter rodeo. Bailey McLean also works for Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
We just thought it was the perfect way to combine the Western heritage of Sheridan and then the outdoor sporting community that we have here too. So it's really just an awesome combination for Sheridan.
The timing and cold didn't stop residents and visitors from watching and signing up to compete. Over 2,000 people gathered on the sunny Saturday morning in downtown Sheridan. The competition was the largest sanctioned ski-joring race so far this year in the U.S.
How many of you have never seen ski jewelry? Are you first-timers here in Sheridan? Heck yeah, that's what we like. This is the biggest
event. It's quite the display. We're watching 106 ski joring teams, which consist of a rider, a horse, and of course a skier, barrel down a course made here in our downtown core on Broadway Street.
The skier holds onto a rope as the horse pulls them down the course.
Go, go, go! Don't let go! Don't let go!
And if you think they're not going very fast, you're wrong.
Fast times. We're going to see times in 16 seconds today. This is an 800-foot-long course. We got six jumps, multiple gates, and rings.
Parker says building the course was one of the biggest challenges they faced this first year.
So bringing 400 dump truck loads of snow into your downtown is something that I don't think anybody's really prepared for. And what that looks like when you start out is pretty staggering and stunning.
McLean helped organize a lot of the day and managed to do a little racing of her own on some of her horses.
This is Katie. She's a quarter horse. This is her first time.
It was McLean's first time ski-joring too. She and Parker say the event isn't only to get people out of the house. It's a way to get horses out of the barn during the winter.
Sheridan has an incredible equestrian history, and there's a lot of people out here with ranches that ride every single day, and they're itching to get their horses out for a run even in the wintertime.
It's obvious that Parker was happy about the event's success. He was brimming with joy as he watched his town fill up with bundled up people, excitement, and competition. Parker says he's hopeful they've created a new winter tradition in town.
I'm seeing people that haven't seen all winter out and enjoying this today. So it's really exciting. And I wanted it to focus on a family-friendly event to draw people into town, to give them something to do. And it looks like that's exactly what we've got.
Just so you know, we're new. We don't know what to do. We're winging this right now. This is year number one.
For Wyoming Public Radio in Sheridan, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
Up, will Wyoming go against the courts and go ahead with a grizzly hunt? And we will hear what the state's congressional delegation has to say about the president's emergency. This is Open Spaces. Listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Back in September, a federal judge ruled the Greater Yellowstone Grizzly should be put back under Endangered Species Act protections, which means the federal government has the last say in the bear's management. But during Wyoming's legislative session, Governor Mark Gordon signed a bill that authorizes the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission to manage grizzly bears. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska asks if the commission does decide to manage the bears, would it be legal?
Senate Bill 93 has two parts. First, it authorizes the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission to issue a grizzly bear hunt, and second, the commission could relocate problem bears to California or other willing states with suitable habitats. Since grizzlies are listed as threatened, these decisions are currently made by the federal government, not state. As to whether this is legal, let's start with the more controversial part of the bill, a grizzly hunt.
If Wyoming moved forward with this hunt, it's just so blatantly illegal.
That's Noah Greenwald. He's with the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the environmental groups that filed a notice to sue Wyoming if it proceeds with the hunt.
The Supremacy Clause of the Constitution makes clear that federal law trumps state law. Yeah, I think Wyoming is essentially throwing a tantrum. They didn't get what they wanted, so they're passing what essentially amounts to an illegal law.
But it turns out it's not so black and white. Paul Weiland is an attorney who specializes on Endangered Species Act issues. He says its legality depends on how the commission decides to design the hunt.
They could try and establish a set of rules that would align the hunt with the 4D rule.
The 4D rule allows the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service some flexibility to allow killing a threatened animal in certain circumstances. For grizzly bears, the rule allows removal in self-defense or in defense of others, and when bears get too comfortable near people.
And they could presumably, if they're inclined, they could work with the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service to say, you know, this is what we're thinking, get their input on whether they think it's consistent with the rule.
Weiland says in that case, it's possible this rule could be revised to allow a hunt that targets problem bears, but it would have to look a little different than other hunts.
In terms of, you know, the way one might normally conceive of a hunt where you're just issuing a bunch of licenses and maybe putting a cap on the total number of bears that could be killed, that seems like it would run afoul of the law right now.
He says it's also possible the commission could get a special permit from the federal government to move forward with a hunt, or the Court of Appeals could overturn the lower court's decision. But is this something the commission is actually considering? State Senator Wyatt Agar sponsored the bill. He says the commission said they would consider it, but they are waiting on some other moving pieces before committing.
Hopefully we'll get resolution from that court case. If we do, this bill has verbiage that'll lay out how they can proceed with the hunting season this year. But number two is we've sent that joint resolution to Washington, and we're hoping to get action from the Department of Interior and from our state delegation back there.
But if all those options fail, Agar says the hunt is on the table. As far as the part of the bill that would transfer grizzlies to California or other states, that would also need approval from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but could be more feasible. Peter Alagona, who is the founder of the California Grizzly Research Network, says there's some validity to the proposition.
I'd say the ball is, to a certain extent, in Wyoming's court. If they're actually serious about this, like I said, and if it isn't a joke, then maybe this cracks open the door for some kind of innovative future conservation effort.
But he says California is a long way from being in the position to where it can accept grizzly bears. For the time being, the bill looks more like Wyoming legislators making a statement about where they stand on the issue rather than actually making any changes in management. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Some Republicans are up in arms over President Trump's emergency declaration at the southern border, but Wyoming's Republican delegation is mostly supportive of it. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
This week, the House overwhelmingly passed a measure rejecting Trump's emergency declaration so he can build his long-desired border wall. There also seems to be enough opposition in the Senate to reject it, but neither chamber looks to have enough votes to override Trump's promised veto. But Senator John Barrasso is all in with Trump.
I'm also concerned about border security. The president has promised to secure the border. I heard about it again in Wyoming this weekend, and I'm committed to support the president's efforts to secure the border.
And Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney is also on board. She says the emergency declaration is needed because Democrats refuse to negotiate and give Trump the funds he requested.
We could have avoided being in this situation if they had been willing to negotiate in good faith and come to some agreement. So I think the vote wasn't unexpected, and I think you just got to, you know, make clear people understand it was political.
Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi says he's still making up his mind as to how he'll vote.
I'm taking in all the information to see what happens.
This week, the White House sent the vice president and a Department of Justice lawyer to the Capitol to meet with Republican senators, many of whom raised serious questions about the legality of the president using an emergency declaration to go around Congress. Tennessee Republican Senator Lamar Alexander and a group of other Republicans are asking Trump to rescind the emergency declaration.
I haven't changed my mind. It's unnecessary, unwise, and inconsistent with the U.S. Constitution.
But Cheney disagrees. She says in the 70s, Congress set up this process for emergencies, and she says it's working as planned.
I just disagree with that. I think the statute's clear, the process is clear, and in each instance, you know, the president's got to make the determination, and Congress has the ability to approve it or disapprove it. And, you know, we're operating in terms of what the statute lays out, and, you know, it's in each case, it's up to the Congress to make that determination whether or not they want to terminate the emergency.
Only 13 Republicans joined every Democrat in the House in rejecting the president's emergency declaration this week. Republican Congressman Justin Amash was one of them. He says Republicans like Cheney and Barrasso, who were up in arms when former President Barack Obama claimed executive privilege, are being hypocrites.
I think many of my colleagues know that they are being inconsistent, but they feel that politically they're in a bind.
Amash says many Republicans are afraid to oppose Trump on anything.
If they oppose the president, they run afoul of many Republican voters in their districts, and in large measure, they're responsible for creating this situation by always supporting the president, even where they disagreed with him. They've, in some sense, trained all the voters to thinking that the president is doing the right thing all the time.
But Senator Barrasso brushes aside the criticism. He says Senate Republicans are unified, even if a few vocal members are opposed.
There is uniform agreement in the conference that we need to secure the border. There's an emergency at the border, and border security and national security are tied together. There are different ways to accomplish the goal, but we are united in the goal of securing the border.
Some Republicans are worried that a future Democratic president could use this new precedent set by Trump to go after people's guns or even to declare climate change a national emergency. But Barrasso doesn't share that fear.
Whether what the president is doing is, you know, goes forward or not, and I believe it will, I don't think that changes what a Democrat liberal president who's taken this far left, hard left turn where the presidential candidates seem to be going. I wouldn't be surprised if on the campaign trail they promise to use executive powers in ways to do things that I wouldn't like at all.
The Senate will vote on the measure in the coming weeks, unless the president decides to rescind his emergency declaration. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Earlier this month, students at the University of Wyoming had the opportunity to visit a traveling Black History Museum. The informative and sometimes provocative gallery of artifacts is curated by historian, activist, and former middle school teacher Khalid El-Hakim. Wyoming Public Radio's London Homer Wambeam has more.
Yeah, so I'm trying to play that.
In the University of Wyoming Student Union, a long line of students make their way down a row of tables, carefully examining artifacts, many of them taking photos with their phones. They are visiting the Black History 101 Noble Museum. Some students were sent to the museum on a class assignment, but many are drawn to the tables out of curiosity. Khalid El-Hakim describes the reaction students have to seeing his collection of artifacts and what he wants them to take away.
I see students who walk through this exhibit and they see an aspect of American history that they've never been exposed to before. And some of them look dumbfounded, some of them look mad, some of them are upset because they haven't seen this, they haven't been exposed to it. And, you know, so ideally we want people to be inspired by it and to go out and do their own research.
The museum is a chronological series of photos, documents, vinyl records, and other artifacts. Some of the materials are shocking depictions of racism from popular culture in the Jim Crow era, while other artifacts recognize accomplishments of African Americans in the form of signed magazine covers, protest signs, and photos of triumphant activists, artists, and community leaders. Some of the material is incredibly personal. El-Hakim recalls a leaflet he found from a lecture by Carter G. Woodson, the historian who started a precursor to Black History Month. He was shocked to recognize familiar names on the program.
On the inside cover are a list of the patrons that bought him in town in 1938. Among that list are my grandparents, and which blew me away.
That kind of activism is what El-Hakim wants to carry on. Wyoming has one of the smallest Black populations in the country, which creates challenges in exposing students to African American history. Dr. Frederick Douglass Dixon of the UW African American Studies Department helped bring El-Hakim to the university. He feels that many people don't get enough Black history education.
And I'm sure this would be something that would be literally seen as a first time in Wyoming.
Dr. Dixon describes how powerful it is to have the Mobile Museum visit Laramie.
What it means to me is Black history personified. So being an African American history instructor, this evokes thought, this ignites conversation, and it has folks and makes sure that they deal with a reality. Whichever way they deal with it, put it in front of them in a practical, physical sense.
Many students agree they had never been confronted with Black history in this way. Freshman Molly Pyrus elaborates on what she learned from the exhibit.
In California, like in history classes, you know, they just kind of teach you about the slave trade and Martin Luther King Jr. and nothing else in between. So it's kind of cool to see how all of the pieces fit together.
Back on the tour, There is a pileup of students conversing at the last table where El-Hakim has set two modern-day artifacts, a copy of GQ magazine featuring Colin Kaepernick and a red Make America Great Again hat. El-Hakim explains that these two items are representative of the current state of racial discourse in the United States.
On the surface, that sounds great. America first, I get that. However, when we know that America first has always been the theme of the Ku Klux Klan, that's where the problem comes in. It resonates with a certain group of people, and people respond accordingly when you have the President of the United States saying, America first, make America great again.
67% of Wyoming voters voted for Trump in the 2016 general election, more than any other state in the country. That gave El-Hakim some concerns about displaying the hat, but he decided not to censor himself.
My job is not to make people feel comfortable. My job is to show artifacts, and all I'm doing is simply showing an artifact that represents current discourse in America. And so with that, it gives us space to have a conversation. So you have Trump supporters that are going to walk through here. You have anti-Trump folk walk through here. So where else are we having this conversation? All right, we're not having it in our homes. We're not having it in our religious institutions because they're extremely segregated.
The Black History 101 Mobile Museum brought to Wyoming a rare occasion to confront and discuss these issues. El-Hakim feels if he didn't include modern issues that people have opinions about, museum visitors might distance themselves from older artifacts. He wants people to understand their personal connection to not only Black history, but today's racial tensions. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm London Homer Wambim.
In our last segment, I will visit with Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. With the end of the legislative session, Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon is spending most of his time reviewing bills. Takes a break to join me to discuss the past legislative session. This year, there were a number of bills that infringed on local control, with the biggest, of course, involving the dispute between Teton County and the Jackson Hole Classical Academy. I asked him what he thought about this type of legislation.
Well, Bob, as you know, I've always been a local control guy, and I hate to, you know, see the state overstep into those areas. And in both of those cases, you know, I've just gotten the bills. I'm looking through them, thinking very, very thoughtfully about it. You know, in the Jackson case, my concern is that the state reached in broadly, you know, sort of to the whole of the state and tried to solve a particular set of problems, but they really applied to the whole state. And I'm trying to get a kind of a sense of what that means. I don't like it, that approach, and I really do struggle with it. And so I think the state's going to have a conversation, certainly something I'm going to work on for the coming year, to say, what does it really mean to have local control? And if it is, by golly, we should keep with it.
I mean, there were other bills and some that didn't even get very far. Did you ever have a chance to talk to legislators about it?
I did talk, and actually just kind of all the way through the session, mm-hmm. trying to get a sense of where it was. You know, it's interesting because there was a lot of momentum, as you know, in the legislature, well discussed and all that, a lot of momentum in the legislature, but our calls were running pretty substantially against, you know, I think it was called SF-49.
Mm-hmm. Governor Mark Gordon visiting with us. I know during the campaign you talked a lot about we're not really ready for some taxes yet, although the legislature, the House, got a lodging tax to the Senate, also a corporate tax. I want to talk about that second one first. Is the corporate tax something that maybe we could take a look at as a state? It probably, I think, surprised some folks this first time out. They hadn't had a chance to really understand the issue. But that seems like one that might work to diversify things a little bit.
Yeah, I think the challenge with that particular bill as it came about as a surprise, it was pretty, it's pretty technical in its nature. The idea was that you were just going to be collecting taxes that were being paid elsewhere, but there were some problems that showed up. And, Santerra, because of its corporate structure, it's the outfit that does everything in Yellowstone Park, wasn't going to pay taxes, but, the Grand Teton Lodge Company was going to be paying taxes. And so I just think it got bogged down and really kind of confused. I also feel that at the beginning of the session, I think there was an effort on the part of both houses to really think about what do we do to broaden our tax base? And yeah, you may remember that earlier even than that, there was a kind of concept about broaden and lower, a couple of other things. So they were trying to cut at that. The House did the heavy lift, and the Senate kind of got a little bit cold feet, halfway through the session. And we see that from time to time. The lodging tax, on the other hand, that's been a proposal that's been around for a couple of years. It's gotten refined. My concern on these is that as the lodging tax was brought forward, it was pretty narrow in its implementation. There were some ways to look at it, and it certainly had the industry's support behind it, but suddenly it became kind of a Christmas tree and ended up overloading. And ultimately, we didn't do anything on revenue.
Do we need to at some point?
Well, I've said pretty substantially that I think our issue is trying to figure out how we get our spending in line, and specifically, Bob, my concern as treasurer, and you and I have talked about this before, is that yes, we do have savings, and sometimes those savings can help fill that gap, but we don't have a sustainable fiscal future. We need to get to a sustainable future, and I think part of the problem is the way our budgeting process goes. It's not as transparent. We have ways that move money around in the budget that people don't necessarily understand. We've got to clean all that up.
Governor, changing gears, you were talking about diversifying the economy and us bringing more revenue in. Mm-hmm. One thing that I think a lot of us didn't talk a lot about, but I want to hear your thoughts, is these blockchain bills that went mm-hmm. through. Mm-hmm. I think this is a fascinating thing that's going on in the state. We've got companies and businesses from all around the world that are watching Wyoming. I know you've participated in some of this. How significant was the legislation this year?
Well, I think the legislation this year was remarkably significant. It may take a little bit of time to catch on, but just for example, last week I was at the National Governors Association and was talking to a couple of governors, including the governor of Puerto Rico, which is also making a play at the same place that we are. And he said, Wyoming is way out in the lead on this stuff. We're trying to figure out what they're doing, and we like what it is. I think, obviously the legislatures, Tyler Lindholm and Ogden, have done a great job with this, but Caitlin Long has brought a level of sophistication to this that really puts Wyoming in the forefront. And because we've talked a little bit before about the Kansas City Federal Reserve and my time there. They've kind of coordinated with the Federal Reserve and others, so it's really building into a space that is new, novel, and has a lot of opportunity.
Well, when you talk about Caitlin, she's the head of the coalition that's been working on this and has really facilitated a lot of the conversation, not only in our state, but nationally.
That's exactly right. And now it's kind of fun because, major companies, it's not just little crypto coin outfits that somebody sort of puts in their trailer and hauls around trying to figure out how to mine new coins that are showing up here. It's also major companies, and so that's I think that's exciting. JP Morgan, for instance, just announced that they're going to have JP Morgan coin. Clearly, crypto is beginning to have more of a role. And then just the whole blockchain universe, which isn't necessarily around cryptocurrency. It's about digital asset control, and that one was one of the most exciting bills, this digital asset repository.
Yeah, and for people who said, what is that? That's like a bank for these types of things.
Well, yeah, it's sort of the way a bank used to be. The depository can't be making loans and all that stuff. It's just a way to be able to hold and your digital assets in a protected way.
And I'm hearing already there's banks or those types of operations that are trying to come here.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's a couple of big companies I don't think I'm at liberty to say what the names are, but they're sizable. People will recognize these names. And if they locate in Wyoming, that's terrific. Certainly one of the things I've talked about for the last several years, Wyoming has a great setup for this, is Wyoming becoming more of a financial center. Already it's a great place to do insurance. It's an important state that way. And then just thinking about financial management, asset management, family offices, all of that area, we can compete with any place from New Hampshire to Singapore. We can do that in Wyoming.
Governor Mark Gordon visiting with us. Okay, session's over. Ed, what are you looking for here in the next few months? What kinds of things will you be working on, and what will your focus be?
Well, Bob, I began the session really talking about the importance of coal to the state and the opportunities we have to move our nation forward, not just by reducing the amount of carbon that's going into the atmosphere, but by actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere. So Wyoming could actually be the leading state sort of driving to that carbon negative solution. And we can do that. It was one of the things I talked about was standing up this coal pilot project. Legislature was pretty generous with that. We got the Energy Authority together. We've been talking to DOE and others. I'm very anxious to see that, we can begin to really make a dent in carbon. Made a couple of, I think, strong statements about our responsibility to do that and feel very good about that. We need to work on energy all in all to make sure that we do a better job.
Governor Gordon, a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Christine Semro survived addiction by moving to Jackson and immersing herself in the wilderness. When StoryCorps came to Jackson last year, Semro sat down with StoryCorps facilitator Madison Mullen to talk about the first time she felt at peace in nature.
I was just kind of beginning to sober up. Was probably still crushing 12 packs, but trying. And up the mountain we went.
And what mountain is this?
It's in Teton National Park. It's part of the Teton Wilderness, and it's serious business. I mean, there's real animals out there, and it's 3 hours into camp, and you're riding a horse and dragging all your hopes and dreams up this mountain. And I was with my boss, and I just remember looking at him and looking at what I was doing and looking at my dog and thinking, wow, I cannot believe that I made it. I made it through a drug addiction. I'm sobering up. I have a job that I love. I'm doing something that 1% of people in the whole world do. In the whole world. So I still got that 1%er ranking. You know what I mean? So I was excited, and I knew at that time that's when things were taking a turn in my life, that the wilderness was going to take me somewhere. And I knew then, this is it. And it's been 20 years. So Jackson kept giving, and I kept staying, and I'm still here.
Christine Semro and StoryCorps facilitator Madison Mullen talking at StoryCorps in Jackson. David Graff produced this piece. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again, you can find them on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
You might be one of those people who only hears part of the show. To make sure you never miss it, you should sign up for our podcast either through our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Anna Rader for putting those together and for taking care of our website.
Thanks to all of you who support Wyoming News, from this show to our legislative coverage. You can join them by pledging through our website. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.